charitable event is a benefit for the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, a project of the East Bay Sanctuary Covenant. For more information, call 510-483-7481. That's 510-483-7481.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, just returned from Egypt with a cold. Yes, and so all of my bodies are slowly wafting in. So we're going to weave Egypt with women, money, and marijuana this show, a few weavings of context beforehand. Part of what I bring from Egypt, the iconography, is something in front of you that might be scary, like a cobra is an oppositional enemy, but something beside you, like a cobra, becomes an ally, and something behind you, scary, like a cobra, becomes a protector. So part of the iconography and part of our kind of assignment right now is to take anything that's scary, we might be thinking about money, anything that's scary and swoosh it, aikido it to one side and to stand behind one as well. So first, a few responsible announcements. KPFA will be broadcasting special Democracy Now! Coverage of the March for Science, Not Silence in Washington, D.C., and satellite marches on Earth Day. That's Saturday, April 22nd from 7 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific Time. And the People's Climate Movement in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, April 28th from 7 to noon Pacific Time. Democracy Now! Will cover both marches from D.C. along with some coverage of the satellite marches. Yes, thank you to our great program directors and our colleagues. Okay, so team, the sun has just entered Taurus, which is called the incarnation of Venus. And there I was climbing Mount Sinai with the help of a camel named Michael Jackson, able to see the heliacal rise of Venus before dawn. Ooh, and to climb Mount Sinai and to bring back not so much grumpy commandments as trickster guidelines. So here we are. We remember that Venus represents that part within us that connects us to the world, that is about love, beauty, art, intimacy, kinship, and yes, money. So more than perfectly, our show today is Women, Money, and Marijuana. In the first segment, we welcome Kate Levinson, author of Emotional Currency, that I'm perusing to great effect right now, A Woman's Guide to Building a Healthy Relationship with Money. Kate is convening Women, Money, Spirit on April 29th, a great conference at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And for our second half, we'll be bringing in Ellen Comp, Deputy Director of California Normal, a.k.a. Nola Evangelista, author of Token Women, a 4,000-year history of women and cannabis, which will be quite wonderful. But first, welcome, Kate.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Carolyn.
Yes. That's great, and I can almost hear, I know we're in our experimental realm here, but that's great. So yes, I realize we know each other because I had gotten other announcements about the conference that you'll be convening, Women, Money, Spirit, and one of the people from Point Reyes said, you met Kate last year at the Call of the Forest conference in Point Reyes. She and her husband, Steve Costa, were the conveners. So it's like, yes, we do know each other, right?
That's right. We've been together.
That's adorable. So thank you. And then, but it was your email So that was one announcement. But it was your email on women and taxes that I opened right on tax day when I was feeling particularly waifish and daunted and forlorn and a little bit about money, going, oh, right, women, money, and taxes. Oh, thank you. Yes, we do want women in full wealth, self-possessed of money and sacraments to increase our intimate, competent cahooting in all the realms and safe enough to take the interesting, liberating risks. So I love your book, and I love the fact that you called it emotional currency, because way back I hosted an economist who said all of our metaphors for money are all water, cash flow, liquidity, drowning in red ink, rising tide, and currency. So is this part of your, is this part of how you navigate with money and water as kind?
Well, actually, I you know, my background is as a therapist, so I think metaphorically and I think symbolically about money, and I feel like we each have such different relationships to money, you know, based on our experiences, based on our psychology, certainly based on the culture that we live in. So I don't consider myself an expert about money other than my own life, but I encourage people to find the right metaphors for them and to become more aware of what their relationship to money is. I think the cobra is so appropriate, right? That it is this cobra in so many ways in our society and in our personal lives. And so we kind of try to run away from it. But that the more that we can work with it inside, like all things else in the universe, that we can find a way to have a better relationship, to use it in ways that are aligned with our values. So, yes, water is one, certainly, that people talk about water, but also, you know, it carries so many different meanings for each of us.
Yeah, and I'd heard, well, again, the realm of water going, yes, it's like the feng shui people say, you know, stick a bowl of goldfish in your wealth corner, and we go, okay, so water and money have been always very linked. But I also loved listening to your podcast with your colleague in which you were talking about enough. And
yeah.
I love sending back to you the wonderful Peruvian women saying that the job of the women is to tell the men when to stop hunting. We have enough hunting or drilling or whatever. We have enough. So I just wanted to toss that back to you in the enough discourse.
Love that. So we have the capacity to know when we have enough. But given the air that we breathe in this culture, where I don't think the concept exists actually of enough, right? Especially around money. That I once had a financial advisor say to me, "Everybody wants more money." Well, I don't think that's true. But given how much significance money holds in all of our lives, how much it impacts our lives, and the structure, the economic structure we live under, tells us that we never can have enough, that we need to live in fear, that there's something wrong with us if we don't have more. The money will fix us. Again, it's in the air that we breathe. I think we all struggle with this notion, you know, what's enough. Of course, it's easy if you don't have enough for a roof over your head or for food to feed your children. Of course you don't have enough. But after that, after you have enough for the basics in life, what we consider the basics is a question too, then this becomes relevant. When is enough enough, and how can I be satisfied with what I have, given that money solves lots of problems, but there are lots and lots and lots of problems that it doesn't solve in life. So
yeah. You also mentioned in emotional currency and a crucial theme of compensatory. You know, when we're not satisfied with some part of our lives and then we use things as compensatory, a kind of toxic mimic to make up for things. And I do, you know, in the realm of confessional, being a Libran, possibly flibbity-gibbet, going, yes, I will, you know, as opposed to my Cancerian thrifty friends who are like thrift store and budgeting and all those things. And we go, oh, this guy, because it does bring up, all of the things, you know, delinquency, shame, waifishness, being with wealthier people and having, you know, the not attractive things come up of anger, well, resentment and envy, whatever,
yes.
and feeling sometimes like a spy. I remember being with very wealthy journalists, and they were all talking as though I were part of them, going, and what do people do with credit card debt? Do they make minimum payments? I mean, oh, how appalling. And I'm like, ah!
Yeah.
Ah. Anyway, so there's the outlaw theory there. But
we do. We do live in these bubbles where I think I'm often shocked by the assumptions people make about my life and my finances based on their own. You know, again, I think we're used to separating, using money to separate us from one another, and we have difficulty even imagining that someone we know and love is in such a different financial situation than ours, in debt, let's say, or has a lot of money. How do we navigate that? So we put these blinders on. And because we don't talk about it too, Carolyn, you know, because of the taboo, we don't talk about money in any real, well, in many real ways with even our close friends.
Well, yeah, because it is so, and until now, that's really great. Because part of the beautiful sky earth story of now is here we are in the Venusian realm and Venus is returning from the underworld, you know, Pluto, death, rebirth, intensity, scary things we want to make our ally is stationing today. And in the language, Pluto and Scorpio and the eighth house represent everything that was thought of as sacred, death, sex, money, and power, that has become taboo. And it is sort of our assignment to take what was sacred, become taboo, and restore it back to sacred, which is really what you're doing. And we want to touch on this conference too. Yeah, because people will talk about sex more than money because of its feelings of vulnerability. If one doesn't have enough, one is waifish. If one feels one has a lot or inherited money, one might feel like one is a target to be hit on. You know, I mean, anyway, all these things. So I know you're convening the Women Money Spirit Conference on April 29th at CIIS. And what is your dedicated aspiration for this conference, that we may make money sacred again, possibly?
Yes, absolutely. That we can learn to get out of the stranglehold that money has, and to in our culture, and to see money as something sacred that can be used to connect us and support us and nurture us and feel vulnerable about. Of course, we feel vulnerable, you know, but not carry that shame and not carry the taboo, because when we talk together, I find when women talk together, the kind of support and creativity that opens up when you look at your relationship to money, it has to do with, you know, what it is to be human, really, and what does nurture us. And so talking with one another, you know, I think it's such an important time for community in our world right now anyway, but we can't figure out our relationship to money alone. So having the idea of the conference is having women of diverse races and financial situations and educational levels and ages and coming together, so that the more voices, the more diverse voices we have, the closer we can get to see what is sacred, because otherwise we're just left to think, well, this is just how I feel, or I'm doing it wrong, or, you know, I can't figure this out alone. It's all personal. It's my fault that I don't have more money, or, as you said, it's, you know, I'm a target, or why I didn't really deserve to inherit this money. And, you know, we're just filled with so much negativity and self-judgment. But when we come together, we can, I think, see what is essential and how can we use money to our relationship to money to create lives and that where we feel connected to one another, and we use money to support the kind of world we want, to align our values with how we relate to money. It's not separate from spirit. Yeah.
No, and I love what you're doing, and I do, as I mentioned, love your calm, reassuring voice. I think it's really great. And, you know, over the years, every now and then I would join some, you know, prosperity course but I would often then bail out because it was too Hinayana honky. It was too just me kind of thing. However, in one of the courses where I did find the teacher way too Hinayana honky, but she had this exercise, you know, write a love letter to money. And part of me was like, nah, nah, nah. But somebody else did a very interesting job. And I go, okay, dear money, we've had some great times together, usually followed by long periods of estrangement in which I would not return your call. But I, and I thought you'd been hanging out with unsavory people. But I realize your journey has not been easy either. And I think we'd make great partners. You know, give me a ring. Anyway, and I realized there is a quirky relationship between relationships and money, right? I mean, it was like that kind of worked. It was like, oh, they are somehow connected. Do you connect them?
Yes. Yes, and that we can, much like we learn a lot about ourselves in relationship to other people, we learn a lot about ourselves in relationship to money. It's a window into our feelings and our psychology and what our work is. It's a spiritual practice, and it reveals so much about our own psychology. So I really love the love letter to money, which is, it's also an ambivalent relationship, that there have been good times, and then we know that absolutely terrible things are being done because of money.
Right. So we do want to...
Even we do things that we feel shame about. Because...
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's also, you know, the micro to the macro. I mean, we're speaking to our beloved KPFA mothership of Pacifica Radio, and all of the complexity of left-wing progressive, and as we know, KPFA, does not pay its weekly people. You know, we do all this for free, for love and everything, and fund drives, but the complexity of, progressive left-wing to money, like we need it, but we don't respect. I mean,
right.
it needs a psychotherapist, Kate.
Well, even in my own life, I would never, I disavowed money. I was a hippie. I was, the idea that I would, quote, specialize in money in a therapeutic practice or in my work would have been abhorrent to me. But, how we're called to do things, thank God, thank the goddess that we are called to do things that we think aren't so good. And I've learned so much. It's I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful for I could say in part metabolizing money in a different way than either of my parents were able to, or metabolizing
right.
it. Transforming it internally in a way that's different than what the white, wealthy financial men are teaching us about money. And so I'm really grateful to the richness of this work and freeing myself from... So my story, just a little, it was that I had no idea that I was making decisions based on money in my life. And when it became clear, it was... it was shocking. But then I was able to begin to see what money meant to me and what it helped. You know, then I began to be able to see money in my life rather than just my ideas about money. And I could see my relationship to it and through understanding it, come to, you know, work on some of the places where the wires were profoundly crossed for generations. You know, I think we inherit through our DNA, we inherit some of our ideas in relationship to money based on what our ancestors' experiences were. So
definitely. Yeah, no, that's, I've been having, I think we, our lives are a series of ongoing, like, revelations when we're ready for them. Because even out in the Sinai Desert, a wonderful place of clarity, I would have dreams. And, you know, and even dreams about my parents' relationship to money, which was pretty fearful. It was pretty fearful. You know, even when things were going well, there was a lot of fear, and then there was a lot of loss, and then there was playing with the big guys and losing all the money, you know, and then the family story, which I've been questioning. We all want to question all narratives, really, you know, that it's my mother who wanted my father to make money and made him quit the job that he liked, you know, then to make money, and but it didn't work out either way. So he, you know, so that was the story. I don't think it was actually true or fair, but that was the family story. And I can remember as a little girl going, I will never do that. I will never snooker myself or anybody into, you know, leaving something they love. Anyway, it's all interestingly slowly unraveling over there. But that's great. So I mean, do you guide people to stable, mature relationships to money, to, you know, you know, because right now, again, just overcoming the conniption fits, and composting the shame and the whatever, hearing grown-ups, you know, or when ads come on and go, you know, do you have enough for retirement? I always turn that off immediately, going, you know, how large are your savings accounts? No, change the channel, turn the thing off, run out into the woods. But again, so you're where people are hysterical. I mean, can you guide them like horses, going easy, easy?
I've never
easy, Caroline.
Thought of that one. Well, I do lead groups, and the group together, you know, kind of finds the right resonance for each person to. I should say, within the group, we each find the right resonance for doing whatever the healing work is, you know, because it's, again, so different. But certainly understanding the narrative, understanding the family story, understanding, you know, why my father organized his life around money. That insight really helps to put a piece of the puzzle or connect a certain dot so that I can be free to make some of my own decisions or, again, heal some of the wounds that my father wasn't able to heal when his father died when he was 8. Or, you know, my parents fought about money all the time. So it just understanding that, healing that, and as I work with people individually, but I think that there's a power in the collective in it, why this conference is important to me. This is the second one. And I think, you know, having the Latina voice, having the African-American voice, having the Asian voice, having the Anglo voice, having the East Indian voice, having the different perspectives, all of these people have some spiritual practice. So what that means to me is that they're looking beyond just themselves. They're looking to be connected to the world and caring about the world, and how do we look at money? What is the face of money when we let the feminine, when we let it have a feminine face rather than the financial services, which there are plenty of really wonderful women, especially now coming into the field or taking more of a place in the field where they bring heart and they bring caring values. It's not just the bottom line. It's not just making more money. But it's still dominated so much by a negative masculine, you know, a selfish, take all, bottom line. And so what does this feel like? What does it look like? How does it change in our lives? How does it impact us to hold money in this bigger way? So I don't know if I guide, but I love having conversations about money in my own work. It was stunning to realize what money held to me when it had just been completely out of my awareness, out of my consciousness, though operating. I could see it in my behavior, but I just, I'd been in training, I'd been in analysis, the field of psychology. I don't know about these days, but certainly then money was of no import. I mean, what?
Which is quirky because analysis is pretty pricey, right?
Right. Maybe it's part of why you don't want to bring money into it. And also just the way that it serves the status quo, the culture. You know, it's embedded in the culture, and the culture refuses to be reflective, contemplative about money. I mean, that when you say we talk about sex and we have sex education in school, we don't have, very rarely does a school have financial literacy, which is, we all need to know about money. We all deal with money.
Right. And I think in a large cultural sense, and perhaps your beautiful conference, upcoming Women Money Spirit Conference, April 29th at CIIS, because to heal the dichotomy, I've been recently meeting a number of women who are happy to be financially secure, working for corporations that destroy the earth, but not being able to look at that. We go, no, that's not good either. There we go. There are ethical ways to make money. There we go. May everybody be freed from that. And I've tended to be, on the kind of scampering on the edge. Let's put it that way, scampering on the edge. But I do love. Do you know Marge Piercy's charm for attracting wild money? Do you know that thing?
Yeah. It's
very darling. I will apologizing to her, but I will rub my hands with honey and run through the vaults of banks. I will not, come money. I will not chain you in trust funds or dark rooms. Soon you'll be free to join others of your kind. Come money and build a murmuring swarm in my purse. Very charming, right?
Hi.
Oops. Oh, hello.
Good. Hi. Hi.
Did we lose each other? Hello.
Oh, we're here. Uh-oh. We're on again. I think we have each other.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
We're here. I hear you. Yeah.
Good.
Very good.
And the disconnect that you mentioned, even about progressive organizations and individuals, I was really shocked when I sat on a board once and realized that the way the money was invested was completely antithetical to the mission of the organization, and there seemed to be no concern about that. So it just speaks to how disconnected we are, I think.
Right. Yeah, and again, I think this is such an important and wonderful dynamic. I like thinking of this as our kind of part one conversing, and I will certainly telepathically attend Women Money Spirit Conference and follow.
Wonderful.
And follow your work as well. I do love the Panchatantra, the oldest frame story in the world, just begins by saying money is not that important, and what person with things to do in the world would concern themselves with that which is not important, so money must be had in sufficient abundance so you don't have to think about it. I'm like, well, that's one answer to enough.
Then there's also praise Allah and tether your camel. Right?
Yes, but tie your camel first. Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Right, the practical steps, and the healing that practicality is spiritual in a dedicated way, and I think that's part of.
Yes, absolutely, and not to be ignored, not to ignore the maintenance parts of life.
Right, exactly. So, thank you for your beautiful work.
Thank
I'm
you,
probably going to let you. go as we segment in, because we're an experimental radio right now, and it's a little hard for me to hear the connection, and I don't know what will happen when we bring in the next guest.
Yeah.
But all good wishes to your Women, Money, Spirit conference, and to us thinking of this as part one.
I love that.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you so much. Much appreciation, Carolyn, for all your
work. That's great. Oh, good. Thank you so much. And more to be continued spiraling forth. Thank you so much, Kate Levinson. Woof, woof. All right, this is Caroline Casey. We are experimentally connecting to KPFA. I'm just back from Egypt. That was Kate Levinson. We're going to take a very short break with our usual Taj Mahal, and then we will bring in our second guest, because it is 4:20. Our second guest will be Ellen Comp, Deputy Director of California Normal, a.k.a. NOLA Evangelista, author of Token Women, a 4,000-year history of women and marijuana, which will be great. And now here's our very short break music.
She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Caroline, if you could talk, that would be great.
I'm sorry, say what?
You're on.
Hello, I can almost hear everybody. Okay, we are on experimental radio, but it is Caroline Casey. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show for part two, which is our welcoming of Ellen Comp, Deputy Director of California Normal, also known as NOLA Evangelista, author of Token Women, a 4,000-year history of women and marijuana. So welcome, Ellen.
Thank you very much, Carolyn.
Oh, that's great. There you are. So I have your wonderfully witty book before me, and it's almost, you know, as I open each page going, really, that woman? And Hildegard von Bingen, really? And it would almost be a shorter book if you mentioned women who were not involved with marijuana. Because it's very, very charming. And I also love your adorable blog. Everybody can see more at Token, T-O-K-I-N, woman.blogspot.com, and also very important, potheads.com, which is extremely fun. So yeah, 4:20 women token. And so this is a great thing to bring up, all the time, but especially today, 4:20. And you're at a normal conference on the East Coast right now?
Yeah, I'm in Pennsylvania. There was a lobbying day yesterday, and there's going to be the first ever medical marijuana conference in Pittsburgh, PA, which is my hometown. And so I'm doing broadening my perspective, I guess you could say, this 4:20. And it's been wonderful to watch it, happening all over the place. We've now got, I think, 23 states with some kind of medical marijuana law. A majority of Americans live in a place with medical marijuana legal, and we're seeing positive results. So there was a study 2 years ago that states with medical marijuana laws have 25% fewer opiate overdoses. People are substituting a safer drug for a more dangerous one, for pain medication and that sort of thing. And my hope has always been that it will enlighten us up in a lot of ways. We really need to
in order to, you know, save our planet and all the living things on it.
Exactly. No, that's great. And, you know, as I was kind of weaving for Kate Levinson healing the relationship between women and money, oh, what a good idea. And really everybody, the inner woman within everybody. And then now to our sacrament, you know, so it is, we are in the Taurus Venusian realm, incarnation of Venus, love, beauty, art, kinship, yes, money, and intimacy with the world, which is, I think for all of us, it's so effective to be able to say, did you know that Hildegard von Bingen, did you know that Maud Gonne was ahead? Did you know that Helena Blavatsky, and then not quite Queen Victoria, we don't know for sure, right? But her doctor was in favor of such a thing, right?
Yes, wrote about it in the first edition of Lancet and prescribed it for menstrual cramps and that sort of thing. So, when I started that very important Potheads project in 2002, I really felt like it, more than anything else I did, it really broke people's perception open, you know, because people have one perception of marijuana, and then they say, well, you know, Bing Crosby was a big pot smoker, and they're like, why, you know? And so then I started really focusing in on the feminine, you know, because, of course, I was especially interested whenever someone was a woman who also had a relationship with it. And, you know, I brought my book brings it up to the present time where women are starting to talk about what it does for them, like Alanis Morissette says it jumpstarts her creatively and things like that. And so we're starting to be able to, and we're seeing it reflected in the popular culture too, where, you know, movies are showing women using it and then having a revelation and changing the course of their life. And it does have that power if it's used properly, I believe, and I found in my life.
Absolutely. And I think in keeping with, you know, when I counsel troubled parents about their kids' drug use, I always say, what kind of drugs are they using? And they're like, oh, marijuana, cocaine. I go, big difference.
Yeah.
And let's just say, what Andy Weil and I were kind of brewing a long time ago, what brings us into kinship is a sacrament. What plunges us into alienation is a toxin. And that's what he was saying, you know, whole plants, good little white powders we're taking, you know, the alkaloids out of the community of the plants, and so it will only take us out of community. And that seems to settle people down. Because I would say to the troubled parents going, how does your kid seem? And they go, well, kind of wonderful. And I'm like, well, leave them alone then. That's fine.
Anything can be overused, yeah? Of course. You know, have you seen Jane Fonda in the movie Peace, Love, and Misunderstanding, where she plays a hippie grandmother called Grace, who actually turns her grandchildren on to marijuana and tells them, you know, nothing white, nothing brown, nothing up the nose, you know, makes the distinction for them, but brings them back from a night where they were about to close down and go onto their devices or something, and brings them back to some kind of actual communication with her and with mankind, you know? And it was really beautifully done. I'm not as fond of Jane's portrayal of Grace on TV, where she's more of an alcoholic, and they portray Lily Tomlin. This is in this Netflix thing, Grace and Frankie. I don't know if you've seen it. And they portray Lily Tomlin, who's the pot smoker, as kind of a mass of insecurities and things like that, instead of the real powerful woman that we know Lily Tomlin actually is. But check out Jane if you're interested in this Peace, Love, and Misunderstanding. It was made, I think, by Ted Turner's company, and I like to think it's more like Grace is on a good, or I mean Jane is on a good day.
No, that's great. That's great. And you know, and then also just, you know, we're concentrating on the women in your book, but I also love the reggae singer Pato Banton, whose great song, I Do Not Sip the Coke, I Only Smoke Marijuana, you know, Sansa Mia. Again, mm-hmm. Wonderful distinctions, but I also can't help myself perusing your book going, Louisa May Alcott, really. heaven bless.
That's the reaction I would hope for, yeah. Because it's not, I've always looked for the unusual, the non-stereotypical one. You know, I'm not going to write a book and say, hey, Snoop Dogg smokes pot. Like, yeah, we know that. But, Louisa May, you know, at the time when Louisa May lived, the late 1800s. It was available in pharmacies. People were trying it. This guy, Fitzhugh Ludlow, had written a book about called The Hashish Eater. And a lot of women also read that book and tried it. And I document some of the bohemian women who tried it. And then it can be traced back to, coming back to your very interesting Egyptian experience. You know, my kind of thesis is that, you know, the whole use of it kind of got, you know, drummed out of the West through various things, you know, our mythologies, the witch burnings, whatever, and survived in the East and was rediscovered by the West around the time that Napoleon invaded Egypt in 1800, and his troops discovered it, brought it back. One of his generals was Alexandre Dumas's father, who was half Haitian, and Dumas then wrote The Count of Monte Cristo, which has a hashish-smoking character, and writes about it very beautifully. And then there was the whole Club de Hashashin in Paris that, you know, Baudelaire and all of those who tried it and wrote about it. And but then there were a lot of women at the time, too, who also traveled to the East and learned to use the nargile. Harriet Martineau, the first female sociologist, she's often called. She's the great-great-great-great-grandmother of Kate Middleton of England. And she tells a story about being in a harem with Jewish and Arab women, and on the Sabbath, the Arab women would blow the smoke into the Jewish woman's face so that she could also enjoy the experience without breaking the Sabbath. And so it was kind of a beautiful moment in East-West relations, as well as maybe the first shotgunning known to man that was recorded. And then Gertrude Bell, who you picked out, who actually there's a movie that's finally out now with Nicole Kidman playing Gertrude Bell. She was called the female Lawrence of Arabia, although she was kind of more than that. And she was this aristocratic English woman who traveled around with this entourage all over the East and did diplomacy or maybe spying, depending how you look at it. And brilliant woman. And she also, according to her biographer, you know, began to enjoy the nargile and in which, you know, tobacco, opium, or marijuana was smoked. And she would relate stories that she heard about one or the other. And, you know, she, you know, was really a, you know, powerful, amazing woman. I mean, obviously not your stereotypical lazy pothead kind of a woman, right? You know, she accomplished a great deal in her life. And while using the nargile, you know, Martineau wrote about it later, about, you know, kind of missing the experience when she was back in England. You know, there was this great difference between, you know, the Europeans who would go to the warmer climates and stuff, they would write about it, like, the, you know, this sort of lost Elysium and stuff, and then they would go back to where, you know, Ernst ist das Leben, life is difficult. You know, there was such a difference between their life in England and the life that they would see in these foreign countries, and it all became very exoticized and eroticized, even, you know. And you even had like the Middle Eastern clubs in this country, you know, that would put fezes on and march around and walk around and stuff. And the Turkish exhibit in 1876, back to Louisa May Alcott's time, had a tent where hookahs were smoked, and in the Turkish exhibition. And then, you know, the backlashes would happen. The whole history is, you know, flowering backlash. You know, then there was a backlash at that time, and then it came upon again in the 20s, where you had blues singers and jazz singers and bohemians and artists using it, and then another backlash, you know, and then we had the, made it illegal in 1937, basically, in this country, and, you know, it's been up and down, and now I think we're on an upswing.
And also, apparently, Groucho Marx was called Groucho Marx because Groucho was a term for your stash bag.
Yes, I have Chico Marx on tape saying that on a British television show. He said it was a little, they carried this little bag around their necks. They called it a grouch bag. He said, we would keep, you know, pennies, a little marijuana, whatever we could pick up. Well, we were studying to be musicians, he said. And this is in the 20s. It was legal in this country in the 20s. That's when Bing Crosby did it, you know. And he was probably better off staying with that than with alcohol, which he ended up using in the end. And I hear this story a lot, actually, when, say, a couple is busted for pot and the guy takes the rap and then he's drug tested, so he becomes an alcoholic. And I've seen a lot of marriages break up over that sort of thing. You know, he's nice when he smokes pot, but he's a jerk when he drinks, they tell me. You know, I mean, I'm kind of a... I think alcohol has not necessarily done our country a lot of good as far as the violence that it can engender, you know, the violence against women, that sort of thing. I'm seeing women more and more. You know, women have been tracking... We're 10% less likely to vote for marijuana legalization than men, and that's been constant. Now that women are now finally in the majority, now that 60% of men are in favor of marijuana legalization in a lot of polls. And that, you know, but women are now becoming more and more able to more freely talk about it, and take the lead as far as the marijuana industry and become the face of it and everything. And that has changed, and in the recent states that have voted in favor of legalization, we've seen more support from women, and that's been good. And so that was one reason I wanted to write this book and bring it out at this time, because we were, you know, about to face the California vote, and I want women to understand it's not just about, you know, Cheech and Chong, you know. It's there's a broad, long herstory of women being involved with it. In fact, you know, back to the Goddess times, which I consider you an amazing expert on. I don't know where you get a lot of your information. That just blows me away every time I listen to you, Caroline. But, you know, back to like the goddess Sashat in Egypt, who I had never heard of, but I've seen pictures of her wearing what looks like a pot leaf in her headdress. And she was known for the stretching the cord ceremonies in before they built the ancient pyramids, you know, to measure them. She was the goddess of mathematics and writing and all of these things. And they say Sashat opens the door of heaven to you, which sounds to me like they have the psychoactive kind too. And, you know, a lot of this knowledge we're just trying to piece together from not much written information, you know. But that to me, and then gets into the Queen of Sheba, right? Who there's this interesting connection with her and Sashat, because the Islamic versions of the Queen of Sheba story have a strange tale where Solomon polishes the palace floor so he can see her legs, which were reputed to be the legs of a donkey. Now, this a female with having the legs of a donkey shows up in the Greek Aristophanes comedy, The Frog. And that comedy is the one that brought in Dionysus as the, I think it was the takeover of the goddesses having the sacred sacrament, you know, the Kikaon and the Eleusinian mysteries and everything. And it became, what happened is, and they think this is, that this play talked about it, Alcibiades, who was a Greek general, basically stole the Kikaon from the temple of Hera and started partying with it at his house, you know, with nymphs and hot tubs and stuff. And this, to me, is where the sacrament remains locked to this day, right? We've taken it out of the sacred realm, and it just becomes something decadent, you know, instead of the holy thing that I think it is. And so, anyway, Sashat, this comes back to Sashat, because in this donkey-legged woman supposedly also was involved in the construction of the Temple of Jerusalem by producing hempen ropes, just as Sashat did. Sheba means star or seven, which is a number associated with Sashat, and Asterion, meaning star, was one of the ancient Greek names for canvas, and the Asterion plant was offered to the goddess Hera, the Greek goddess. So it's like, wow, so all that connects. And then also this goes back to... Ishtar, because, okay, now the Queen of Sheba, the, you know, the Ethiopians claim her for them, right? But she was probably maybe Sabian from, you know, southern Arabia, Yemen. And one of the, some of the incense that was used, of course, the incense in the Bible, we think was cannabis, not translated today, right? So one of the incenses there was identified with, calamus, scented reed, which is how they've mistranslated all these years. But it was described by Pliny as having a specifically fine scent which attracts people even from a long way off, which is, you know, maybe that's our fine scent. So, and that goes back, and then one of the Sabian goddesses was Ishtar, which I start my book with, because she's the one with the knot of Ishtar, which is the hempen rope, aromatic herb Kunabu. Cannabis was associated with her. She's now, you know, became Astera in Greek, in German, and Easter. It's pronounced Easter in a lot of cultures. So she's resurrected every year, you know, in my world. A couple years ago, 420 was on Easter, and I started really looking into her then. And what's the other one we wanted to get into?
I just want to sort of add, because you're opening doors of wonderful intrigue. So when I was recently at the Temple of Hatshepsut, the woman pharaoh of Egypt, and
yes.
she and I share the exact same nose. People in the Egyptian Museum noticed it, going, "Look, you have the exact same nose as Hatshepsut." But when I was at her temple, our wonderful, wonderful guide, all praise to the beautiful Marianne, was saying that it was Hatshepsut who brought incense to Egypt, that they didn't have incense or fragrance before. She went south to Namibia and brought these beautiful trees, and her what is now desert was full of gardens of exotic plants. I'm going, I bet something else was coming in there, if it's incense and things. I feel such kinship with her, 18th dynasty Egypt. I'm tracking more of it, but it's like, yeah, to bring aromatic incense and gums and things, you know, from the south, from Nubia, that makes sense, right? That she would also be bringing sacraments, possibly.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, you know, Solomon's temple had 400 incense burners, and I mean, what better way to start a religion than to get people in the spirit in that way, you know?
Right.
And, you know, the names have been changed, but it was actually Suma Bennett, who was a female archaeologist, who made the connection between that and cannabis. So, I was in bed one night thinking, Queen of Sheba, what were those spices, you know, and started looking into it. And, you know, I haven't proven it, but when I was in Jamaica, they told me that the Rastas have always said that the Queen of Sheba brought cannabis.
Yes, that's great. Yeah.
So,
it's certainly mythologically true, at least, right? And so we love that. Also, I mean, we're all right now, you know, Jupiter, all of us retrograde. We're all stirring our own journeys and cauldrons, and the art forms we've had around us and our affinities are all kind of pertinent to be brought up into now. You know, everybody who brought what to this Renaissance. But so Sheba was my childhood heroine. I insisted on going at the age of 6 to the movie Solomon and Sheba, a biblical cheesy thing, but everybody was like, that's not a movie for a little girl. See this little lightweight comedy. I'm like, no, Sheba, I must see Gina Lollobrigida as Sheba. It was very, very important to me, and I loved it. I loved it. But anyway, so just these little quirky affinities throughout our lives are very important as they all begin to kind of come together, and your book is very, very charming that way. And just in a random way, because I have my finger in many, many different pages of your book, but I just also wanted to bring back into being, you know, in the Louisa May Alcott, heaven bless hashish if its dreams end like this, but you write, starting in the 1860s, the Ganja Walla Hashish Candy Company made and marketed maple sugar hashish candy. It's like, I must have some now. That's fabulous. Maple sugar hashish.
Someone I know in Berkeley has brought them back, and I think you can get them at the CBCB. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
I might have to move to California to get the Ganja Walla Hashish Candy. Maple sugar.
Yeah. Right. I always think that you are out here, but because KPFA.
Yeah.
But
right.
My
voice is such as it is. But it's like, I don't know. It's awfully attractive. It is my second home. But anyway, but that's wonderful. And then I'm grateful for Gertrude Bell, all the beings that you're bringing up here, which is so wonderful. And it's kind of quirky, because when I was thinking of her, she's a complex person, Gertrude Bell, because she was, you know, she did learn Arabic. She did fall in love with a young officer who read her Hafiz, the Sufi poet, as you write. And she never married. We love, but she published on Hafiz and learned Arabic and all. But she was fairly colonial. And I was thinking of the women adventuresses too, going, well, they had to have money, right? I mean, just to tie it back into our first segment, the money allowed right. them to be adventurous. She had a castle in Syria. So we go, all right, we wish women sacraments and financial security to take the interesting risks. But there she is with her nargila. And then, you know, in our, just for the fun, you can go anywhere you want, as you know. But I love, I mean, there's the obvious people as we get into the modern world. You know, Billie Holiday, yes, yes. Bessie Smith, of course, Give Me a Reefer, Isaac Dinesen. Yeah, and then also Mary Shelley, and it turns out that Percy was really stuffy, because Mary was talking about being blissed out on hash, and he was sort of, and she was like, oh, it's heavenly, and he, being an ardent atheist, said, don't use that word. It's like, what a grumpy guy Percy was. But anyway, back. So is there anybody also? I love Maud Gonne. Do you want to just bring in Maud Gonne, the love of Yeats's life, who treated him fiercely? And then she says, thank you for the dream drug.
Oh, Maud Gonne, yes. She was, William Butler Yeats kept asking her to marry him. He was madly in love with her. She was an amazing Irish revolutionary who just gave these stirring speeches and brought everyone. There's a line in them, Downton Abbey, where they said they were afraid the younger daughter was going to turn into Maud Gonne, and the powers that be were very afraid of that because she was so powerful. And she tried hashish with Yeats in Paris around the time when Havelock Ellis and them were experimenting with it. She was using it very much to awaken her psychic ability. She had had a child who died, and she was attempting right. to contact that spirit. And in another case, she described feeling as though she was transported to the bedside of her sister who was dying. So, you know, and this was around the time also of Blavatsky. So I don't know too much about her, but she's a fascinating character. And she said it's a great drug, and it clears up profound mysteries. And, you know, so there was this sort of spiritualist side that was also involved in, like, Jack London's parents were spiritualists, and he was also someone who tried cannabis and wrote about it, and in fact wrote about the perils of alcohol as well. And so there's that whole tradition, as well as the more bohemian artist tradition, which I guess resonate with a little bit more, and so I know a little bit more about that side of the people who tried it. You know, Lewis Carroll was thought to have, I mean, you know, he had the hookah-smoking caterpillars. This is also right around the mid-1800s, around Louisa May Alcott, Queen Victoria. And also Mary Todd Lincoln was treated in a sanitarium yes. that used hashish. And she's right. another one. We don't know whether that was prescribed for her, but it well might.
Oh, we're all too soon on our way out. But I yearn to cahoot further. I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing, Nola Evangelista. That's so wonderful. And your wonderful book, Token Women, and also your very important potheads.com, and also Token, T-O-K-I-N, woman.blogspot.com is wonderful. And these are just great provocative things. I'm going to dive in and research more and more and more all these wonderful women for whom we feel affinity. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to have been here. Thanks.
That's great. And thanks always to Erica Bridgen. Thank you for being such a stalwart, experimental, good board op here as we are shifting our broadcast realm. And thanks to the audience for being patient with our broadcast. I'm Caroline Casey. Remember, better a trickster than a martyr be. And we will reconnect next week with Daniel Javario. Woof, woof, woof. Thank you, team.
When you think of the Hard Knock, you think of that.
Station of Resistance.
One of the most phenomenal beats of all time.
Good information and great radio.
News, views, and hip-hop.
What?
Do it the way you feel it.
Hard Knock.
Hard Knock.
Hard Knock Radio.
Monday through Friday.
And it's from 4 to 5 p.m. knocking hard in your area.
94.1 KPFA.
Only revolution is our evolution.
So good.
You're invited to two nights of music and resistance in honor of Berta Cáceres. Honduras Rota singer Carla Lara with Afro-Indigenous author Melissa Cardosa will perform 13 Colors of the Honduran Resistance, stories of women resisting brutal repression and finding unyielding hope. This event happens on May 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Redstone Building, 2940 16th Street in San Francisco, and May 4th at 7 p.m. at Soul Space, 1714 Telegraph Avenue in downtown Oakland. Both events will benefit Eco Viva, who supports the Council of Indigenous and Popular Organizations of Honduras. Both events will be bilingual.